Accession number 29958, Reel 2.
I do want to talk about your experience, obviously, as time would progress in relation to the war, but I wanted to just speak to you briefly about the earlier phases of the war. And you mentioned to me seeing the invasion of Belgium, obviously the experience of Dunkirk. Prior to Dunkirk, how was the war being viewed from a young bloke's point of view, 15, 16-year-old in Perth, Western Australia?
Well, I think the average young person was very confident that that we were going to win the war. The British Empire would win the war, but of course, we thought it was going to be a lot easier than it turned out to be eventually.
Where did this confidence come from, do you think?
it's difficult to say. Possibly youthful foolhardiness and being. Most people are fairly positive, and I think if you've got a positive attitude and you're yes, that you're confident that we're going to win through eventually, but of course it didn't turn out that way, and we were in a situation where things were getting very serious, and of course London and Britain was being bombed, and Dunkirk. We met with the first big defeat was Dunkirk, and the evacuation from Dunkirk was terrible. Lots of casualties. So that sort of dampened our ardour a little bit, and I think we then started thinking that it's not going to be as easy as that. But nevertheless, that didn't, as an 18-year-old, that didn't seem to enter the equation. It didn't seem to worry us, because I think maybe our adventurous attitude towards war at that stage meant that we were keen to support Great Britain and the Empire, and especially Australia, to ensure that we Hitler was defeated, so that we would be certain to retain our freedoms. And so I think that our attitude was fairly positive as a young man, but because maybe you didn't face up to reality. The reality of war, and of course we were at that stage we were being in Australia and so far away from the action, you didn't really appreciate, other than seeing what you saw on the newsreels, the ferocity of war and what can happen with the bombing that went on against England or Great Britain, the way it was bombed, and until you eventually got there, you didn't really appreciate what these people went through, because we were fairly isolated out here in Australia.
Here you are. You mentioned Dunkirk. Yes. Was there ever a time when you thought, we're talking Panzer tanks here, and dive bombing
Stukas, yes.
Messerschmitt,
yes.
High technology in action.
Yes.
Was there ever a time when you thought, we can't defeat this?
No, I'm afraid I didn't. I never thought that. I was always very positive about it, and maybe because of our youth and the adventurous spirit, that we felt that we would. Would eventually win as a group of nations, a group, an empire group of nations, and of course Subsequently, when after America came in, which virtually was, let's face it, was our saving grace, and I believe it's only just in the last year that that Great Britain paid the last of the billions of dollars that were advanced by America for aid to buy all sorts of munitions and ships and aircraft and what have you, and so it's fairly ironical, isn't it, that that it has taken 60 odd years to repay our debt of such and actually I couldn't believe that I wasn't even aware that there was a level of debt to that extent owing by Britain to the USA. It's phenomenal, isn't it, really, when you think about it.
We could talk about the coming of the Americans a bit later, and I was interested that you mentioned things like Dunkirk, because my impression is that Dunkirk was a time when young chaps who'd possibly been a little bit ambivalent and not sure which way to go,
yes,
decided. Was that something that you experienced?
No, I didn't. I think we must have been must have had a fairly isolated attitude. We weren't. I wasn't personally worried about it at all. But I can imagine that people much older than I was, who were eligible to serve in the forces, they would be more concerned because of their maturity. But as a almost callow youth at that stage, I think we exuded confidence and positiveness and optimism, I think, and that was our attitude until, of course, we eventually came up to face the real thing, and then, of course, things changed a little.
Talk about that too in relation to you joining the Air Force proper. Let's discuss that. What was involved? How did you come to be involved?
Well, I applied to join the Air Force on the 2nd of January 1943, and I went to interview in St. George's Terrace. I went for an interview, and I had to have a medical examination, and after a matter of weeks, I was advised that I could commence aircrew training at RAAF Clontarf, which is a suburb of Perth, and so I started there on 35 course, which took some months of training, drilling. I remember we had a DI sergeant called Rocky Brooks. He was a Canadian wrestler, and he was our drill instructor at Clontarf, and he used to march us out into the along the roads and into a pine plantation, and we'd knock off, and those of us who smoke could have a smoko. But this fellow was quite a character. I think he was on our side from the point of view of giving us a bit of time off from drilling, from harsh drilling and marching with packs and all that sort of stuff. But and there was another fellow called Flamingo Ryan. He was a very, what they called him Flamingo, I gathered, because he was a very tall, thin fellow who was the warrant officer discipline, and he was he instilled fear into our very hearts on the drill square. And he was not a very popular person, whereas this Rocky Brooks fellow sergeant, he was a great guy, and anyone that gives you a break you admire, and those that come down on you hard, you might respect them, but you're not very happy with their attitude.
In relation to joining the Air Force. Your brother had obviously joined.
Yes, sure.
In what way had that influenced you, do you think?
Well, I think I'd been... I'd joined the Air Force Cadets. I think he was... He just about was ready to join the Air Force. It may have influenced me more than I thought at the time, but having been interested in the Air Cadets at the time, I was an Air Cadet at the time he joined the Air Force, being a year and a half older than me, he would have been, when I was 16, he would have been 17. No, he couldn't have. So he would have gone in... he went into the Air Force when I was in the country serving in the bank, and I don't think there would have been some influence in that area, but I don't think it was an overriding influence there.
Do you recall letters from him sort of telling you what?
Well, he was at in those days the initial training was conducted at Pierce, which was an Air Force base north of Perth, just not far out of Perth, and he used to tell us about the activities there, but we didn't see much. But being in the country, I didn't see much of him, and of course he wasn't a very good correspondent, and I didn't expect him to write to me. In any case, he obviously wrote to the family or contacted the family through his Air Force training. But I remember when he went to Pierce eventually to bide his time until he was sent overseas, I always remember the story telling me they were the highest paid toilet cleaners in the Air Force, because at Pierce that was their job, because they had nothing much for them to do until they were posted to the Eastern States preparatory to being being transferred overseas to England.
Did you ever know anyone of your age that would not have been prepared to go away? People hear of talk of conscientious objection, that sort of thing. Was that something that you ever experienced in any of your friends?
Most of my friends joined the services, and I don't know of anybody, but I did hear, I have heard, which were rumours, whether they were true or not, I wouldn't know, of people receiving white feathers because they were of the age, but because they were farmers, they were not allowed to join the services. They had a, I forget what they call it,
manpowered.
They were manpowered, that's right. If their job was of some more importance back home, for example, for the production of wheat or other primary production, they were manpowered, and so, you know, that for anyone to receive a white feather, I think was a terrible thing. But I know a lot of my friends that I made in the country during my earlier banking years, who were farmers, some of the people that I knew there were still joined the services, because they obviously had other members of the family who could run the farms, and so they served their country, and of course I dealt mainly with people who were eventually joined the services in my younger days.
Given your experience, given that you would join up in 43, and there'd been quite a lot going on prior to you joining up, was there ever a thought that you might miss out? Was that a concern to you?
No, I was always very positive that eventually I would get to become a pilot and would hopefully eventually go overseas. So I wasn't concerned about it, But I can appreciate the fact that some of the newsreels that were coming into the theatres in those days were fairly off-putting to some people, I would think. But it never really affected me. I don't understand why. Maybe I was a little foolhardy. However, that's the way it was, and I wasn't concerned that if it had happened. I'm a person who accepts whatever happens, and if I hadn't been able to go get away, then I would have to accept that. But in hindsight, I would be disappointed, because it was an adventurous time for young men.
We'd obviously spoken about Dunkirk and the seriousness of that trouncing, basically.
Yes.
What do you recall then of the coming of the Japanese, Pearl Harbor in December of 41, and then subsequent fall of Singapore and things like that?
Yes. Well, I was more concerned about that, actually, and I think most people in Australia were, because there was talk of the yellow masses coming down through Asia and to Australia and invading us, and therefore I was actually quite happy that very happy that America came into the war, because as it turned out, without America, things would have been quite different, I feel, because of their tremendous manpower capacity, their large navy and army and other services, and their financial strength. I felt that was a great help. In fact, as it proved subsequently, even though the Japanese got fairly close to Australia, the Americans obviously, with their strength, their naval strength and air force strength, were able to keep them well north of Australia, despite the fact that they bombed Darwin, and many people are still not able to don't realise how much people didn't realise the level of bombing in Darwin. I was eventually in subsequent years appointed manager of the National Bank in Darwin, and I didn't realise until then the level of bombings. Lots of buildings were destroyed, ships in the harbour were destroyed, and they made dozens and dozens of raids on Darwin and on Broome down the coast in Western Australia. There are graves in Broome of Japanese pilots who were shot down up in the northern areas of Australia. So, but people, there are still a number of people who weren't aware of the level of activity, but I imagine it was because the government may have kept, because of the fear factor, the government would have kept this information or detailed information away from the general population, which I would imagine is was better for morale.
So here you are in the Air Force. Mm-hmm. What was the initial training like? You mentioned that you wanted to be a pilot.
Yes.
Presumably that didn't come about straight away.
No, well, in your initial training, all there would have been about 60 members of 35 course. Now, as I said earlier in the interview, if you were colourblind, if you your legs weren't long enough, if your height wasn't, if you weren't a certain height, you couldn't become a pilot. So, apart from passing all the exams that we had to pass, you had, as long as you didn't have those deficiencies, you had a good chance of becoming a pilot. But the rest of the course, there may have only been 30 or 40 pilots selected from that course. The others would have been sent off to as wireless operators, to train as wireless operators, or to train as navigators, or to train as gunners, aircraft gunners, and or bomb aimers. So fortunately I managed to pass. It was a fairly intense period of study. We had to study apart from doing our drilling, and physical training. We had what they call them a course we had to go through, where you had to climb up walls and under
commando course.
We had to do a commando course, and we had to swim in the river, which was right alongside Clontarf. We had to swim hundreds of yards. We had to pass the swimming and the commando course on the physical side, and we had plenty of drill activities, marching with packs and marching long distances with packs and what have you. But the mental part of it was fairly intense, because you had to learn the theory of flight. You had to learn navigational activities. You had to learn meteorological information. You had to virtually become a navigator, meteorologist, as well as an aviator to pass to become a pilot. So it was a fairly intense course, and we had a course on to have certain legal information. We had a legal officer who lectured us on the legal implications of war and of the responsibility of making wills. We were supervised in making sure that we prepared our wills and had them signed and witnessed before we went away, so that the course was quite intense, and it was, I think most young fellows were fairly glad when it was over, because and having passed, you were then you waited until you were sent to an elementary flying training school, which came some weeks later on. Now, in April of 1943, I travelled to Cunderdon, where the Air Force Air Crew Training, 9 EFTS Air Force Training School was at Cunderdon, and they had Tiger Moth aircraft, which are a twin winged aircraft, a very old fashioned aircraft, but they were a great little single engine aircraft which had two cockpits, and which pilots trained, and the instructor sat in the front and you sat in the back, and you had an intercom. It wasn't electronic, it was purely voice, a matter of calling out through the intercom instructions, and you acted upon instructions from your instructor. And there we learnt, I think it took me about 8 hours of instruction, flying with the instructor, before I was sent off solo.
What was it like to go up in a plane for the first time?
Yes, that's very interesting. It was quite exciting, as a matter of fact. You were obviously a little apprehensive and nervous about it, but it was quite exciting. You, of course, would always be concerned, am I going to be able to withstand the possibility that I might be airsick and couldn't fulfil my duties? Am I going to be a bit scared? It was a little scary, because although these aircraft only travelled at the speed of, I think the maximum speed was something about like 60 or 70 miles per hour, and but they were such good aircraft, I don't think it took a lot to stall them, and that if you stall an aircraft, of course, and it gets into a spin, some aircraft can be very difficult to get out of a spin. But the old Tiger Moth, if you had to make them spin, you'd get up a few thousand feet. The instructor would get you up and instruct you how to get out of a spin, and that was one of the lessons. We also had to in our solo work, we had to do some cross country trips to various towns in the area. Maybe only for 3/4 of an hour at the most, but that gave us the ability to learn to map read. In other words, find your way. You'd follow railway lines, you'd follow roads until you came to a certain town, and then you were given a briefing as to what you'd do. But it was quite exciting, especially going solo. That was quite an experience, because obviously you were nervous, because you had to get that aircraft up and you had to do a circuit of the airdrome. You took off ahead, you turned left, went down the downwind leg, then turned left again, and then you turned across wind, and then turned in to fly, and you had to make sure that you got lined up with the runway and came into land. And of course, am I going to hit that fence? And so it was quite a nerve-wracking experience, but it was quite exciting going solo.